All right, we come today to the end of our study on transgenderism, and Lord knows there's a tremendous amount more that we could say on this subject. In the class that I teach at school, it's kind of a survey of Christian ethics, particularly relevant issues to today, and I don't have a lot of time to spend on all these topics, and I'll spend 4 or 5 days on it, and so the class that I prepared is, correspondingly about that much time here in our Sunday school period. And, what I've attempted to do here is just give us an overview of this topic, familiarize us with it, et cetera, and provide something of a Christian response. Last week, we talked about, in particular, the doctrinal issues surrounding this topic. We talked about how God made us male and female. And so our sex is biologically determined by the fact God gave us bodies, and that gender, the characteristics that go along with those things also come from God. And so any perspective that places your perception of your soul over that of your body, we saw as contrary to the Christian worldview. It is basically a revival of Gnosticism. We have to see ourselves as a psychosomatic unity of body and soul. And we talked about that. We talked about how the fall corrupts both body and soul. We're born totally depraved. Our souls are corrupt. Meanwhile, our bodies decay and they die. But Christ entered into this world by becoming incarnate, and he rose from the grave bodily to save us, both body and soul, to orient our identity to our given biological sex. And so the gospel shows that reversal of the fall. And so having kind of provided and getting that mindset back into our heads today, I want to talk just a little more practically about a few things that we can do in light of everything that we've learned. So last week, kind of the doctrinal foundation. This week, a little bit more. Here's some practical instruction for Christians. And there's a couple of things I especially want to highlight. And so, with that in mind, we come to our first matter, which is just keeping in mind everything that we said about the fall and its effects on causing gender dysphoria. In other words, last week we looked at Romans 1, where Paul talks about how God's wrath is revealed from heaven against all forms of ungodliness. And he goes back to the fall of man, and he shows the consequences of the progression of sin and how it leads to all sorts of corrupting, even bestial behavior, which in some respects culminates in depraved forms of sexual expression. And I want us to remember that, because the fall affects us all. And one of the first things I think we have to keep in mind is that we have to be careful that we don't just look down on people who suffer from this particular sinful tendency. The tendency that causes gender dysphoria in people is the same sinful tendency that you are born with. I've mentioned before, all sin is on a continuum. And so if you have in any way abused sex, for example, outside of the Bible's norms, sex being between a husband and wife in a monogamous relationship, if you've ever lusted in your heart, well, you have something in common with the transgender person. I've mentioned David Pallison, who wrote our book on Good and Angry. He said that he's never counseled someone about any matter, and he's had decades of biblical counseling experience, in which he doesn't, in some respect, share that sinful tendency. And first time I heard that, it kind of shocked me, but then as he explained, it made perfect sense. So maybe I've never experienced gender dysphoria. I've never been attracted to other men or whatever, but have I lusted in my heart? Sure. So it's just, it's just something, this person's farther down the road than I am in my sin in that area, and I may be further down the road in some other area. The way the original sin manifests itself is going to be different in each of us. So we have to kind of see ourselves in the same boat, with people who suffer from this. And if you recall, after Paul makes this point in Romans 1, he then turns in chapter 2 to the people of God at that time, the Jews, and he says, and you do, you're no better. You were supposed to be a guide to the blind, a light to the nations, and you weren't. And if we look at our culture today and we see the, LGBT community being what it is, I mean, in the same way as it was in Paul's time, it is in ours. The fault is the church's. We have failed to be a light. We have allowed our culture to, in many respects, to take this progression because of 1,000 little compromises that we have made along the way. And so rather than just looking down at transgender people, we have to search our own hearts. Okay? So the first thing, along the same lines, we have to remember we're both victims of the fall, and what we mean by that is we're not only sinners, but we're sinned against. And so if you encounter a person, who suffers from gender dysphoria or is a trans person or whatever, we've got to remember that these are still people made in the image of God, and there is a sense in which while we have to maintain the Bible's teaching about this is an abomination and we cannot condone it. We also have to realize that with sympathy that these are people who need help. And so while we can talk here, I tried to give you a lot of crazy examples in our culture just to show the insanity of the LGBT movement. Trans people are actually a very small percentage of it. This is kind of what the left has done in our culture basically is adopt the strategy of the gospel in many respects. The gospel is concerned with the outcast, with the poor and the marginalized. And the left has kind of latched onto this and presents itself as the sympathetic, caring segment of society. And meanwhile, it casts conservative as, judgmental, hypocritical Pharisees. And there may be, times in which that is certainly the case because we have forgotten, that we are fallen and we fail to see how the church has failed in its task. But we have to try to, on the one hand, deal with this sin and call it what it is, and refer to it as, as an abomination. But yet deal with people who suffer from gender dysphoria with compassion. Because you won't be able to minister to anybody if you are just repulsed by them. Okay? And again, I kind of want to distinguish between the LGBT community, or not community, I mean the forces that want to push this down our throats and everything, and just encountering a person, a trans person, for example, in the workplace or something like that. Okay? Treat people with dignity. Finally, the third point I want to make in light of this is to understand that many of these people, they suffer great loneliness, a tremendous amount of anxiety and shame, oftentimes, I got a little quote here, says, as a result, Christians must find ways of helping gender-conflicted people experience welcome identity and community amongst them, discovering for themselves a relationship with God, the transforming power of His loving fatherhood, and the wisdom of His ways. This doesn't mean that we're, we become an, this, one of these inclusive churches that says, well, you can come here any way you are and continue living your life however you want and call yourself a Christian. That's not what I mean. But I do mean that people who struggle from these things need the support of community. There is a whole movement out there, and it's kind of suppressed by the media, but there are websites dedicated to people who are detransitioning or who have detransitioned. In other words, people who transition from male to female or vice versa, and who later found out that it did not provide the deliverance that they want, that they hoped that it would. And many of them look back and they better understand why they acted out. Many of these people suffered from sexual abuse in their youth. They suffered from what we'll talk about next, the hyper masculine perspectives or hyper feminine perspectives and so forth. And they've been victims. They're coming out of that. They're transitioning back and telling other trans people, hey, this did not satisfy. This did not work. And, so many people, you know, who deal with this suffer, and they need help in Christian community. Okay? So, you know, long story short, in light of everything we have to say, we still have to balance that with compassion. In some respects, there's this movement of the left, this LGBT movement that we have to fight and speak against and, you know, vote against and all that, but then practically, individually dealing with people with compassion. Okay? Hope that's understood. All right. Now, the one thing I want to talk with you perhaps the most about that I think is a real failure of the church. It has to do with gender stereotypes. What I mean by that is this. First of all, you can't deny men and women are physiologically different. Okay? So everyone recognizes, you know, physiologically we're different. You little, like I said, you know, little boy is born, a little girl is born, you take a look at its genitalia and you say, this is a boy, this is a girl. Okay? However, there are many today who say that psychologically we're the same. Okay? That basically here's a man, here's a woman, they both have souls, you know, if you believe in a soul. And basically this soul was put in this male container and this soul was put in a female container. But the soul is like gender neutral, and that the body that it is put in is the body that is put in is just sort of arbitrary, I should say. There is this mindset that gender, while sex is maybe clearly different, male and female, in our souls and our being, who we are, we're basically all the same. Okay? Biblically speaking, that's not the case. You're a man through and through, or you're a woman through and through. Okay? There's a reason why we talk about women's intuition, etc. You cannot put these souls into bodies, so to speak, and not have an effect in, because we are psychosomatic unities. Okay? So I got a couple little quotes in this B1 here. Let's see. Since soul and body form an inseparable unity, being male or female characterizes the whole person and not only his or her body. For this reason, we must reject any notion that suggests a human can be divided into a sexual body and a sexless soul. Simply put, a person does not just have a male or female body. He is a man or she is a woman. And it'll be that way through eternity, because you're going to get a resurrected body someday, whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, and that body's going to have some similarities and characteristics with the body that you have now, just as Jesus' body did, so that you could touch, you know, his hands and his feet and know, you know, that he was crucified, though no longer subject, you know, to decay. What that means practically is that, contrary to what we constantly hear in our society today, gender is not simply a construct of society. What we mean by that, when we talk about gender, we're talking about masculinity and femininity, those characteristics that typically go along with being male, or the characteristics that typically go along with being female. Society today tells us that gender is completely a construct of society, because what society does in their typical stereotyping is, if you have a little boy, then, you know, you buy him these sorts of toys and you play these games with him. By contrast, you have a little girl, you buy her these kind of clothes and you play these kind of games with them. And so the child, whether the child is male or female, is just being programmed to be that way. And increasingly that is being looked down on. You know, it's kind of like role playing. You're taught to play this role or you're taught to play that role. And what I'm arguing is, and there's actually scientific studies that have backed this up, to much to the surprise oftentimes of people who've done these studies. There's been places in Europe where parents have agreed to for a period of time to kind of raise their children completely gender neutral. No, like, guns versus tea sets or anything like that, you know? And they do studies. And guess what? The little boys, they still tend to want to manipulate things. They still gravitate towards blocks and building them. And the little girls tend to be more relational, etc. And the reason for that, again, it's because, you know, you are either a man or a woman, okay? God has made you that way. And while society can definitely influence our gender and our perceptions of gender, it does so within the bounds God created, okay? The end of the bottom of the page is, for this reason, terms like masculinity and femininity are not merely the product of society that can be corrected by the society. While society may have a decisive impact on the way that gender differences are expressed, either positively or negatively, society is only influencing the male or female nature that already exists, which are limited by the boundaries God has placed on the sexes by nature. Okay? You're male or female all the way down. Men and women look at the world differently. That's the wonderful thing about the complementary nature of the sexes and how they balance each other. Okay? So we have to get rid of this notion that gender is just a construct of society. But we definitely are, at the same time, we're influenced by society. Okay? And what society tells us, and this is my point, about what it means to be masculine or what it means to be feminine has to be considered in light of God's word. Okay? Let's turn over to the back page here. Anybody got anything right there to stop? And any questions? All right. Well, what I mean by this, while we can recognize there are fundamental differences between men and women, we can also recognize that there are, within the category of man and within the category of woman, there are differences in men. There are differences in women. And we have to be careful about going beyond what Scripture teaches in regard to the characteristics of men and women, or in other words, gender stereotypes. I got a little quote here. In a fallen world, there can be exaggerations and corruptions of what it means to be a man and a woman. There are some very brutalistic corruptions of masculinity, and there are some very trivial and hyper-sexualized understandings of the female that the Bible would clearly reject. Okay? So in other words, what our perception of what it means to be a man and what our perception of what it means to be a woman has to be considered in light of what the Bible says. Because most of us just pick up, this is what it means to be a man or this is what it means to be a woman by how we're raised. And until we consider those things in light of Scripture, a lot of times we just assume the patterns that are established for us and think, well, this is masculinity, this is femininity. Okay? And that's a big problem. And I think the church has done a poor job of establishing this. And after I did this lesson, I thought to myself, well, this is a whole nother Sunday school class here in itself. You know, this ought to be something we talk about, biblical manhood, biblical womanhood. But, I want to share with you, I hate doing this, I'm a little reluctant, but I want to share with you, some awakenings I had, okay, in my growing up, in my home, in my perceptions of masculinity, and especially, and how I later had some of this challenge by my readings on this topic. Okay, maybe y'all have your own stories. I can speak from my own experience. My parents, both born 1928, okay? So that means they grew up during the Depression. The stock market crashed 1929, so their entire youth was dirt poor, okay? My mom was 11th of 12 children. My grandfather was married early. He had 6 children by his first wife. She died. He then married my grandmother, had 6 children. My mom was the 11th of the 12 of his children. He died when my mom was 12, 1940. She had to quit school and went to Louisville and lived with a live with the family member. There wasn't food for the family, you know, couldn't care for them all. And so she was raised by a relative who was not the kindest person in the world. Basically had some free labor there. Meanwhile, my father, born 1928 as well, his mother died when he was 3 years old, so 1931. My father was mostly raised by his older brother. My grandfather, on my father's side, he worked for the railroad about 7 days a week. And, so my dad was basically raised by an older brother on, you know, in Portland, in Louisville. During tough times, you know, you talk to Brian sometime, Brian grew up in County Cork. His father worked in England, and he would show up on Christmas Eve, stay the day, and he wouldn't see him again until the next year. Okay? You know, we like to be home to see our families at the end of the night. I mean, this was what some people had to do to survive, you know. But to my own experience. So my dad grows up being raised by his older brother, my Uncle Lee, who was kind of around him. And, you know, growing up, I heard all these stories about, their exploits and the scuffles they got into, you know, with other boys at a time when being good with the gloves, you know, was important. You know, boxing was a big sport. So my father, boxed in the military. His brother did. My Uncle Lee was the first wave of the assault, on Iwo Jima. You know, the famous Marine flag waving statue comes from that. Back when they were all the all the World War II vets were dying off, and they couldn't provide military funerals. They just had a guy from the VFW post there with a recorder. My uncle got the full, all the Marines in the dress blues, the 21-gun salute, two bugles, all that sort of stuff. But I used to grow up hearing, you know, about their fights and stuff. My dad talked about one time driving down the road. My uncle sees two guys beating up this one guy. He just stops the truck. He gets out and he beats up the one guy because he didn't like an unfair fight, you know. That was the perspective. And I remember I was a little kid, elementary school, and I was being bullied by this big kid. And you're a little kid, you're being bullied by some big kid. That's a traumatic thing. And what bothered me more so than being bullied was the fact that I was scared of him. And it was like, how could I be scared when I'm the son, you know, of my father and my, you know, nephew of my uncle, etc. And there's this tremendous, like, pressure, you know, because being a man, you weren't scared. I've gotten a lot tougher since then. Now I'll shoot somebody, but I was a little kid, all right? You know? I remember, you know, you grow up in that time, and of course you're a baby boomer. You all remember the John Wayne movies, the Green Beret, men's men kind of mentality sort of thing. And, you know, there's a long history of this, especially in the South. You know, duels, men settling things by fisticuffs, you know. And it's one thing to be able to defend yourself, to maybe protect your sister or whatever, but it was kind of this mentality where you go outside and you settle it. Well, that's not biblical. That's not biblical. In the Bible, you appeal to authorities. Okay, somebody's doing something, you appeal to the authority, and the authority settles the case. You don't resort to dueling. You know, think about Aaron Burr and what Alexander Hamilton, what I think it was. That there's nothing biblical about that, but that's honorable. That's pictures of masculinity. You know, Teddy Roosevelt and, you know, that kind of thing. Those are always held up to us as examples of what it means to be masculine. You got something, Paul?
Well, I just want to ask you, isn't it so that in the Bible, you couldn't be dressed in the service,
you could
go to war?
You couldn't, unless your heart was willing to go to war, then you stayed home. I know that they would be put on the supply lines, and the rule was that they received part of the spoils of war, providing that they served in other capacities. Now, here's the thing: in Deuteronomy 20 makes this real clear, though. Most of the wars should have been defensive. So it's one thing if I'm being attacked. Guess what? That's one thing. The problem is today, like in America, we're sent all over the world to fight battles that aren't ours to fight. Okay? And biblically speaking, it's you're under attack and all the men are called up to service. You know, so that kind of, hey, you know, I might get over my fear. It's natural to be afraid. My dad realized what was happening in that situation. Guess what? I was afraid too. You know, I don't know if that ever stopped him, but you know, But he was afraid. But yeah, you're right. You know, you don't go to war if you're afraid. But usually they're going to war because they're under attack. That's the way it's supposed to be. But you know, just to talk about this, you know, growing up that baby boomer generation and stuff, and all the World War II movies, you know, because that was still relevant in people's minds and stuff. You have these perspectives. I remember my father. My father, don't get me wrong, my father was a kind man. People liked him, neighbors, church, whatever. He was a kind man. He was a good father to me. Loved me. But we didn't tell each other. That was just, you know, my father loved me. I loved him. It was understood. We just couldn't, you know, we weren't much into hugging, in case y'all haven't figured that out now, you know. Seth knows it. That's why he gives me a holy kiss all the time, because he knows it just drives me crazy, you know. Are you just being biblical? You're just being biblical. Basically, if I punch you on the arm, just consider that a holy kiss, all right? But I remember the night before my father died, the last night he was coherent. I was up in the hospital, and I knew my dad was in bad shape, and looking back, of course, I should have known he was going to die. And but at the time, he had pulled through many other things, and so, you know, we just didn't talk about that stuff. But the last night he was coherent, a friend of mine came up and visited him in the hospital. My mom would stay with him during the day. I would stay with him at night. And before he went to leave, my friend kissed my dad on the forehead and said, "Love you, Bob." So he was Robert Sr., I'm Junior. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, here this friend of the family can do that, and I can't even do it. But that gave me courage that night to kiss my father on the cheek, tell him I loved him. That was the last time I ever spoke with him. The next night, I got there, he was glassy-eyed, he was comatose. And he, as the night went on, he died. You know, and I was telling him things. I don't know if he heard anything I said. You never know about that, you know, so you try to do that. But, you know, it was that generation, a lot of times they had a hard time, you know, because of that perceptions of masculinity that you didn't do that. Well, that's completely unbiblical, you know. And so when you think about David. David is a man, when it comes, Saul is out there trash talking. And David, he's not 20 yet. He's not old enough to be in the military. He's supplying, he's bringing supplies to the men. And when he hears, not Saul, Goliath out there, he's like, "Look, I'm a shepherd. I've killed a lion. I've killed a bear. I can take this guy." And yet, David, he played the harp. That's not a manly instrument. Real men play drums, right, Ken? Yeah. And he was a poet. If our masculinity doesn't allow for that sort of stuff, then there's a problem with it. You know? People talk about Stonewall Jackson. You know, there he stood like a stone wall in the midst of battle. But people, you know, and here's this, you know, iconic picture of a brave soldier. And yet his biographers always talk about how gentle he was before women, and how if there were little kids, he'd be down on the floor playing with them. And the soldiers who knew him on the battlefield marveled at the way he was with little children. Now that I bring that up to say, hey, our masculinity has to be willing to allow for these sorts of things. And the same is true in regard to femininity. I mentioned to you before, I think, used to get these catalogs from Vision Forum, which was Doug Phillips' ministry. And there was some good material there, but there was all this stuff that was sold for homeschoolers. You had all these little boy toys and outfits and books, and you had all the little girl toys and dresses and books and all that. And all the depictions were these little girls in their bonnets, and you know, like the only thing that a girl was supposed to do was to sew, cook, possibly play the piano, and sit in the parlor and gossip while they waited for Mr. Darcy or Mr. Collins to arrive. And, you know, and you can understand why this Christian material would kind of like do this in response to our culture and its perversion of femininity, etc. But you also have to say, hey, now, is this completely what it means to be a woman? In the Bible, you've got some, as Jim Jordan says, you know, some chicks in chainmail, so to speak. You've got some tough women. You've got Jael, who takes a tent peg and she runs it through the skull of Sisera. Now, how was she so proficient with a hammer? Well, the women generally set up the tents while the men were tending to the livestock. One of the characteristics of the Proverbs 31 woman is she strengthens her arms. Okay? She's into CrossFit, you know, whatever. You get the point. Okay? There's a story in Judges about Abimelech, and he's besieging this city, and this woman takes a millstone. How could she pick that up? And she drops it on his head and kills Abimelech. All right? Dr. Rushton used to say, the Bible says she's a helpmeet, not a helpless meat. Okay? There's lots of encounters in the Bible of women at wells. And the reason is because the women usually, they went and they fetched the water. You know, a gallon of water is what, 7 pounds or whatever? You're carrying several. I mean, that's heavy. Okay? And so to my point, we can hyper sensitize masculinity and femininity and what those conceptions are. And we've got to do a better job of allowing for, you know, hey, it's okay for girls to play sports. All right? In my time, I don't think anybody would, you know, people generally wouldn't, you know, you just think something's wrong with you if you don't fit this stereotype, if you're a tomboy or whatever, or if you're not, you know, hyper-masculine. But in our day, if you don't fit this picture, then, well, you must be trans. If you don't fit this picture, you must be trans. And so people feel this pressure. And this is where I think the church has to do a whole lot better job of saying, what does actual biblical masculinity and femininity look like? Okay? And not hyper-generalize these sorts of things. Okay? Let me read number 4 here. For example, just because a little boy is unusually artistic and gentle does not mean that he should be pushed into thinking of himself as homosexual or transgender. A little girl may be sporty and tomboyish, but that doesn't mean that she should be pushed into identifying as lesbian or trans. Behaviors that would have been accepted as within the normal range even a few years ago, girls wanting to play boys' games or boys wanting to play to engage in rough and tumble games, are now being interpreted as gender confusion. This defies common sense. Now, that's why I sent that article out to you this week by that lady, Lindsay Bentley, who she's writing in response to a couple who had a little girl who was very tomboyish. And because she was so tomboyish, the parents, real liberal parents, decided to cut her hair and get her boy's clothes and start treating her as a boy. And that Lindsay Bentley said, hey, that was me. But you know what? I grew up and I she was attracted to men. She still, you know, if you see in the pictures in the article, she's a pretty woman. She says she likes being pretty, but she likes sports and she likes watching football and all that sort of stuff. To my point, we have to be careful that we don't just stereotype gender. I think there's a sense in which, yes, there are roles of masculinity and roles of femininity, but they better come from the Bible and not from our culture. And I think all of us probably need to consider, yeah, how was I raised? Because we tend to just grow up with what we've been taught without, you know, considering, is this biblical? Yes, sir.
As you're talking, I'm going back to when I was younger, different things that I looked at as too masculine. I'll never forget the first belt. I guess every guy here might be able to remember, you know, these milestones when you got to have a block, or you had pants with blues, and you got a belt. I remember the first belt I had, one of the blue legs gave me the belt, and he watched me, and I was holding him, and I was kind of trying to figure out, you know, what did happen to the belt. And he said, men, put it on this belt loop on the left side, they thread it through this way, women thread it through the other way. There's no way I could have threaded that belt the wrong way. You know, I all said, he said it one time. He said it one time. And he didn't make a big deal of it. So I'm standing there trying to figure it out, you know. I, this,
But you weren't about to have that belt going the wrong way, were you?
Yeah. You know, because that's right there in Leviticus 19. You know. Okay. Anybody else? If you talk to some of the people, a whole lot of things go back to their childhood and expectations and so forth. Yeah. And in our day, more and more, it's like I said, if you're tomboyish and you're a girl, then the expectation you must be lesbian. Or trans, and if you don't fit these characteristics, and I do think there are definitely, you know, masculine issues and feminine issues, et cetera, that, and characteristics that we need to strive toward. To my surprise, maybe it's a decade or so ago, big debate in the PCA about women in combat. And whether they should be or not. Why is that a debate? Are you kidding me? You know? But it was at the General Assembly. They finally decided that women ought not to be in combat. And so one of the things we did as a church, as a session, we adopted a statement, where we made the point that we are against women in combat and women being drafted. If you try to be a conscientious objector after the fact, it's more difficult. But if your church has something on record and saying, we do not agree to our women fighting, et cetera, in battle, then there is some legal protection. I can see the day coming when there won't be, because, you know, The desire for equality is such today that it's only a matter of time that, you know, they're going to be willing to, you know, sign up girls for the draft as well as guys, because if we're going to be truly equal. But, it was surprising, especially among so many the younger pastors, that this was okay. It was irrelevant what the Old Testament said about these issues. It's crazy. I read an article this week about, it had like a dozen examples of transgender women, you know, men who transition, who are now competing in women's sports. You saw it at the Olympics this last time. There's a lady who just set a weightlifting record in like Iceland or whatever. There's a UFC fighter, a man who's now competing in women category. Joe Rogan, the announcer for that, he threw a fit and in this article, they had a video of this fight and this guy is beating this woman. And it's sickening. He broke her eye socket, before they called the fight. And, her face was just bloody. And Joe Rogan, like I said, he's an announcer for that. He threw a fit and he said, men are different. I don't care if you've been on hormone therapy, your bone structure, the size of your hands, your muscle mass, everything is different. And this stuff is just crazy. Anyway, I'm starting to get worked up here, so I better calm down, but anyway, I don't even know where I was
going. In churches, of course, you know, there are a lot of churches where women may have a lot of pastors and elders and leadership roles. Has that had a big effect on this as far as the churches?
Well, I think it's just a world influence in the church, as much as anything. That's why we have to be clear about these things. Again, I want us to be compassionate towards people who struggle with this, but we have to be clear about what the Bible says about the difference between men and women. And that has the fact that God calls men to be pastors has nothing to do with giftedness. All the conversations are about how, well, there are women who are gifted too. And the question is not whether women are gifted, it's whether they're called. And that's the difference. When I stand up here and I'm preaching the Word of God and I'm leading in worship, I am representing Christ. That's why there has to be a man behind the pulpit. And the church is the bride of Christ who is responding to Christ's Word, to Christ's call. And so, you know, I'm willing to grant at any time there are some very intelligent, gifted women who are theologians, and that's okay. You know, Nancy Piercy, when we read her, I would rather hear Nancy Piercy than a whole lot of guys that I know of or whatever. But that doesn't change the fact that you're a woman, you can't be an elder. It says nothing about your quality. It just has to do with your calling. Okay. Oh, no doubt. No doubt. And in so many churches, you know, there's this is a lot less in my experience in Reformed churches, but you'll see a predominance of women. But I mean, when you have these nursery rhymes set to advertising jingles that they sing, I mean, not surprising, you know. There's a reason we sing psalms, okay? Let me finish up here. I'm out of control now. Finally, let me mention this. We have to protect children. Obviously, they're the ones who are really going to deal with this more so than ourselves. Number one here, there's a survey done of 6,000 transgenders in the U.S. Even after transitioning, most of them still suffer. And here's some statistics of people who are transgender. They have four times the national average of HIV infections. 70% have drug or alcohol problems. They're twice as likely to be homeless, twice as likely to be unemployed. On average, they live in extreme poverty. 41%, so 10 times the average of an ordinary person, report attempting suicide. And that's not just because, you know, society is oppressing them. People are suffering. And, we have to especially protect children in this day and age and culture in which, you know, we have this notion of the gender, you know, the choices in bathrooms and people being educated and the LGBT movement kind of becoming the civil rights issue of our day. And that's why, you know, you've got less 1% of the population. And yet from a political perspective, this is the oppressed minority that everybody's got to get on board of helping. Let me end here. Number two, God has put us here in this culture at this time for such a time as this. We could refuse to engage with anyone with problems, but that is not Christ's way. He wept over Jerusalem. We should be grieving over the way that the minds of children and young people are being poisoned against God the Creator. We need to present the case for protecting children from medical interventions that are both physically and psychologically. I think I left something else. That are dangerous both physically and psychologically. It is claimed that in 80% of cases, when children claim to be in the wrong body, if they are left alone, in time they grow out of this desire. Of course, the challenge remains as to how to help the 20% of those who do not. But many would maintain that to intervene is unnecessary and unwise. Underage children are not mature enough to make such momentous choices and decisions. Like I mentioned, in Europe, they're already, you know, curriculum, is increasingly, you know, in sports, everything is becoming gender neutral. Genders don't play sports. You've seen the new Nike commercial. Genders don't play sports. Athletes do. there's just a movement. And so if a boy is a little more feminine, a girl a little more, you know, tomboyish, whatever, then they're like, well, we need to help you transition now because it's going to be a whole lot harder to do once you reach puberty. So we're going to start you on hormone therapy now, et cetera. We got to protect children. So, there you go. Paul? Exactly. I think that's obviously, can we be hypocritical? Can we point our fingers at some sins and ignore others? And yes, and we have to avoid that. But that, I do think that is the case with homosexuality, with the whole LGBT agenda, is to normalize this. Whereas we don't normalize, I would say adultery, but now there's, you know, there's AshleyMadison.com. If you want to cheat on your wife, you can go there and you know, sign up to maybe have somebody else to have an affair. But, you know, there's still not, you know, in regard to theft, there's certain things that the society says is wrong. You don't have this thieves out there who are marching and protesting for equal rights for thieves, et cetera. And I do think that is the issue with the LGBT matters, is because they want to normalize what the Bible calls an abomination. Yes, sir.